Florida Basketball Hour is brought to you by the Gataverse. Gataverse.io, GataVerse.io is an innovative approach to NIL. It connects fans, athletes, and merchants with digital and physical collectibles to verify community membership and grant access to exclusive privileges, VIP events, rewards, and experiences, and athletes receive a majority of the revenue from sales that are done by the Gataverse, which means that it's NIL the way it's supposed to happen, because the majority of the money goes right into the pockets of our student athletes. That's the way it's supposed to work. They sponsor Florida Basketball Hour. I'm a member. I've loved my membership. You will too. Join Gataverse today. Hello and welcome to Florida Basketball Hour. I am Neil Blackman, Saturday Down South. Eric Fawcett, GatorCountry.com will join me in a moment. We are going to start our look, maybe a way too early look, at preseason expectations. I don't think you could ever really do that too early, but we're going to give it a shot today. We're also going to talk about Florida's staff additions. Torian Green was added to the staff. Florida also added John Andrzejczak as an assistant coach. So the Gators making use of the new rule, which allows on-court assistant staffs to go from 4 to 6. Gators going to add Torian Green, who is already on staff, just an internal move. And then John Andrzejczak comes over from Washington State, where he was already working with one of the mentors for one of the mentors for Todd Golden. Sorry, guys, just kind of blanked there for a second. Working with Kyle Smith, he has experience with a bunch of members of this staff, so we'll get into that. But we're also going to talk team expectations, maybe a little way too early, maybe just a little bit of a way too early over and under. There's no Jake Wenderman here to keep score, but if I can, I'll put Mr. Fawcett on the hot seat a little bit. But first, I want to talk about John Andrzejczak, who is the first of two guys, as I mentioned, joining the Florida staff. Andrzejczak, it was funny because I had talked to a couple people in the industry about the Florida staff, and I mentioned Bob Rishi as being a guy who said, it's the smartest staff in basketball, and how he loved that. Andrzejczak kind of fits in that mold. It's got a degree in philosophy from an Ivy League school. So you're not often going to get a guy that is an Ivy Leaguer with a philosophy degree. But that's the story with John Andrzejczak. He has been at a bunch of places. He's been at Dartmouth, where he was the offensive coordinator. He's been at Johns Hopkins, where he was the offensive coordinator. He has been at the University of San Francisco, where he was the director of basketball in basketball operations. He worked with Carlin Hartman, Kevin Hovde, and Jonathan Safer when he was at Columbia, and then as a graduate assistant. And then he was at Washington State, where he was the recruiting coordinator, brought a couple of notable players to Washington State, including second team All Pac-12, but first team All Pac-12 freshman F.A. Abagidi. So I also brought DJ Rodman over to Washington State, which if you watch the World Cup, you know that that was instrumental in getting Trinity Rodman from the U.S. Women's National Team to Washington State, although the COVID year wiped out her entire collegiate career because she decided to go pro, and then was one of the few good players for the U.S. Women's National Team at the recent World Cup, where they bowed out in the octafinals, their worst showing in history. So, Eric Fawcett, on that note, soccer bad, Andrzejczak good.
Well, I thought you were going to ask for my women's soccer takes because, coming from a country like Canada, where, 30 or maybe we're 40 million people now, not super competitive on the national stage in a lot of sports, but women's soccer has always been one that the Canadian women have actually been excellent, but not this year. So, what do I have to say about
it? It's a rough one for the continent.
Yeah, need to reevaluate some stuff on the Canadian women's soccer front, but when it comes to the assistant hire, I think at first I was a little bit surprised last year, and I mean, it's not necessarily a bad thing or anything, but for those people who don't know, and maybe you addressed this, Neil, in the first 90 seconds before I jumped on, but yeah, they changed the rule just before the prior season, allowing two more assistant coaches that are in non-recruiting roles. So it was just kind of interesting to me that Florida didn't use those right away. Which again, it's like, you know, they had Jonathan Sapphire on staff. They had a director of player development, which the Gators didn't have previously. So like, it's not like the Gators, you know, quote unquote, needed more staff or anything. But, you know, it's just like when you have the opportunity, you saw a lot of teams just like fill it right away. Something that if you want to see a good, if you want to see something kind of interesting, go to the Georgia Tech men's basketball coaching staff page and see how much staff they have. It's like, you know, it's starting to read like a football team. Again, not anywhere near a Power Five football team, but yeah, staffs, you know, are getting much larger. So yeah, we kind of saw the Gators even, you know, start that getting in Sapphire in a role that wasn't previously something the Gators had. Getting a player development coach, which, you know, a lot of teams have had for a long time. You know, look to see. I'd be interested if, like, a lot of teams have these director of player personnel, director of scouting. You know, it'll be interesting to see if that's something that ends up happening. But yeah, when it comes to, you know, this specific hire, it's something that I'll say this, it's always kind of one of the funniest things I think we have to do on the show, Neil, is talk about assistant coach hires, just because it's the thing that can be a lot more difficult to quantify. Every once in a while, there's an Eric Pastrana who we knew a lot more and had a lot of, you know, reputation, but most of the time it's different. It's a lot harder to evaluate an assistant hire than a transfer, a player, but, coming off a season where the Gators, were not very good offensively. And we have just called for the Gators to really overhaul what they were doing offensively, bringing in someone who has served as an offensive coordinator, at least outwardly at one position or at one stop. And if he was that, he was probably handling a lot of offense in other situations. So getting someone who has presumably some level or has had some level of focus on that side of the ball, I think that's pretty massive. I don't think he's necessarily going to step in and be the offensive coordinator at Florida right away. And, you know, usurp Hovde, but just having people who are, it's just pretty clear watching what the Gators put on the floor last year that they need some fresh thoughts offensively. So bringing in a guy who has that kind of experience is great. And, you know, I love people who have had success at multiple levels of basketball. You mentioned Johns Hopkins. For people who don't know, like, that is a like Division III powerhouse. They are a top 10 team all the time. Like, that's a D3 team that could for sure, you know, go to, you know, I won't call out too many leagues in Division I, but like they could come to the Division I level and you know, compete in a couple right. of leagues. So that is like, you know, to go there is not like, oh, he, you know, went to D3 and, you know, the Gators have a guy who's in D3 a couple of years. Like this is a powerhouse D3 program. So yeah, I love guys that have coached at different levels, had success at different levels. So yeah, it seems like, you know, again, it's like with your fourth and fifth assistant spots, that are not technically recruiting roles. Are those, you know, like, what are you looking for in those spots? I'd say this is probably, you know, the kind of guy you're looking for in one of those spots that maybe brings something a little bit different, like you said, with his degree and something that probably not a lot of coaches have. Like yeah, just like bring in something different. That's what I think when you can go from three to five assistant spots, that's what you want to do. So yeah, I think intriguing hire, looking forward to seeing how it works out.
Yeah, it is intriguing. I mean, look, the thing with Kyle Smith, who also, you know, gave Todd Golden his start, was that he immediately fixed the defense in Pullman. And it was always about like, hey, can they get to where they're efficient enough offensively to threaten to make the NCAA tournament? And they did that the last couple seasons. You know, never really being a bubble team. Well, I guess in 2022 they were, you know, on some first four out lists, but last year certainly not. Hovered around 500, went to the NIT, lost their first game, much like the Gators. But point being, they improved offensively every year that Andercheck was on that staff. So last year ended up 65th or in offensive efficiency, and it was the defense actually that fell off a little bit last year. So I think Andrzejczyk can certainly help with that. As Eric mentioned, you've got these staff expansions to non-recruiting roles. So a guy that's been a recruiting coordinator, the other thing I like about it is that he could step in if Florida has a staff departure and, you know, hit the ground running from a recruiting standpoint. The other internal hire that was made, was an internal hire, that being Torian Green, who goes from an off staff position and into the assistant coaching position. So he'll be a on-court assistant. He was on the court anyway last year, but now he'll be an assistant. It's all very confusing. It's really, from what I understand, really about player development with Torian. He took a real leadership role in that aspect to begin with, and that's just going to continue. He just now kind of has a new title.
Yeah, no one needs to be told who he is, I'd imagine, if you're listening to this podcast. But again, it's one of those things too that I almost almost like for someone like him, if he wants to be, you know, if he's serious about wanting to coach at the Division I level, it's like, it's, you know, it's pretty big to have an assistant coach kind of role on your resume. So if he was serving in somewhat, this is what I see with a lot of these, like with the expanded roles, is like there's guys that were in player development roles that really, you know, deserve assistant roles, but they just don't have, they're just not able to do that technically, right, given their restriction. And now this is a guy who, you know, has an assistant coach role and can start kind of building that resume, even though it's like maybe his day-to-day is not drastically different this year than last year, but at least you know, one day on his resume, it'll be like, you know, assistant coach at the University of Florida. And that's pretty big. So it's also helping some guys, you know, I was going to say get their name out there. Not that Torian Green needs his, you know, name out there. Pretty well-known guy in the college basketball circles. But yeah, build that resume. And I think you're seeing that a little bit more across the country. There is a lot of like young guys who maybe would have more barriers and just getting into the coaching game with more opportunities, more chances for guys like that to get on staff. So yeah, I think that one made a lot of sense to a lot of people promoting him.
Yeah, and again, same, you know, he had been in the player development role with the Bulls in the NBA and then at Florida. So I doubt much of what his situation or responsibility is going to change. But as Eric said, I think certainly helpful as he moves and progresses up the ranks. He's always wanted to coach like his dad, Sidney Green. So can't imagine that plan has really changed for Torian. I'm sure that Todd Golden and everyone associated with Florida basketball would love to have Torian around as long as possible. But in this business, if Torian becomes sort of a hot commodity, then, you know, that won't last very long. Maybe it's good that, you know, he's in that assistant role and can just kind of continue to shine in his little area of expertise, which is player development, while also gaining some understanding in other aspects of coaching, which maybe would happen now with an on-court role. So the bulk of this show is kind of unique because Florida had its first team workout, I think yesterday. And then they have another one today. They have another workout tomorrow, and then their break. So just a short, like, set of workouts. And I might have even gotten the dates wrong. Could have been Thursday, Friday, Saturday. But whatever the case may be, it's like a three-day situation, and then there's an actual mandated NCAA break. But the point is, they are on the court as a collective for the first time. So I thought that it would be kind of fun to talk about just some expectations for the roster. I kind of wanted to start it with the team. And the way I decided to do this to make it not boring for everyone was initially thought, hey, we should get Jake Winderman on here and kind of have him go back and forth, almost like we're playing a three-man weave with this deal. But I couldn't do that with Jake, but luckily Eric was available, so it's not just me rambling at you all, and I promise we'll get started here. Point is, I'm just going to throw out a stat, and I'm going to see what Eric thinks, and then I'll talk about what I think. But last season, I will start with tempo-related statistics, and this is kind of fun as a team. When you look at this roster, Eric, if I told you that last season the most possessions that Florida had in a game was 88, and I won't tell you who that happened against, but it was 88. Do you see Florida besting that number with this roster? Understanding that there's a lot that goes into how many possessions in a game, including who you're playing. Or do you see that being really high and just not quite something Florida gets to?
Yeah, like my first reaction would be like, yeah, if you were like truly gonna like bet on this, the it's like streaming defenses in fantasy football. Like, yeah, you kind of want a baseline level of like the defense you're looking for, but it's also like it matters a lot of like where you're playing and how. So like of all the things that we as in whether you want to talk you or me or general Florida fans of all the gripes we had about a disappointing season, tempo was not one of them. I don't think. I certainly personally didn't have any issue with the tempo at which Florida played at, and I didn't hear a ton of people clamoring for like we like Gators need to play faster. So honestly, that number is pretty high for the college game where possessions are kind of average in the mid to low 70s for most teams. So I'm gonna say under that, and I just wanted to be very clear with people that when I say under, that wasn't like you know, like saying anything regarding playing slower would have been very triggering to people in maybe the previous team. So I just want to be clear. I'm gonna say under that, but like I've no problem. I think pace will be solid for the Gators and where they need to be to compete at the high major level.
Yeah, I think that's true. Look, Florida had 9 games of 80 or more possessions last season, according to Synergy. I think they might get over 88 in that Miramac game. It's possible that that happens. Just sort of depends on how Florida decides they want to go about attacking the different zone defenses. Florida was really good against zone last year, which is like kind of the one bright spot for them offensively at times. Not all the year. Obviously, Riley Kugel became kind of a bright spot late, but beyond Colin Castleton, there wasn't a lot. I think they could get back to that 9 games of 80 or more possessions. What I will say is that and I think this is kind of fascinating, you know, in conference play, Florida had 3 conference games that got to 80 or more possessions. Gators were 2-1 in those contests, lost to Vanderbilt, beat Georgia, beat South Carolina, Eric.
Yeah. And again, like, That is one that probably, again, you sounds like you're looking at the numbers. I'm not, but I'd have to imagine that when Colin Castleton went out, it turned into a little bit of a situation where, like you see in the NCAA tournament, where oftentimes, you know, if you're the lower seed with less talent, you want to lower possessions and add some variance. So, you know, and adding in that the Gators were just, you know, continually gassed at the 5-man position. Maybe it was a conscious effort to play a little slower. But again, I was happy with the tempo that the Gators played at. I want to say they were in the like 140, 150 kind of range in terms of average possession length, which I think is kind of where you want to be ish at the high major level. So I'll be interested to see their tempo, but not a major concern to me. As actually really not a concern at all to me. We'll see if this is something that, you know, has to come up again, but I'll say not a concern at all for me.
All right, the next one I wanted to go, and I'm sticking with some Synergy numbers just so we can talk team here. And again, I mean, we'll do more specific stuff on the over-under show that comes in October, but this was an interesting one to me because it does allow us to kind of evaluate this roster vis-a-vis last year's roster when we talk some of this stuff. Florida played zone on 16% of possessions last year defensively. You thinking higher or lower with this roster?
Lower. I that's a quick one for me, just knowing that Golden just played so little zone at San Francisco. And while those rosters were different, less like more size in the front court. I mean, I guess this year will be kind of similar, but if we look at his best San Francisco team versus last year's Florida team, like a little bit more, like more length at the backcourt for the Gators. A lot more length and size of the front court for San Francisco. And I just think when he had that kind of, if you're playing, you know, multiple 6'10" plus guys on the floor and not playing zone, clearly you want to be a man coach and you're comfortable in that. And I thought the Gators were fairly successful. The one thing that's, and this is like an overarching thing, I thought about writing about it this summer, but decided it was just like too nerdy, but like the SEC was like really one of the worst shooting team or leagues in the country last season. And I think that that may be because the SEC sucked so bad, and their numbers are like worse even in conference than it was in non-conference, where, so even if you look at their overall numbers, the SEC is bad. I think they were even worse than the overall conference numbers. And of course, like there's a little bit of chicken or the egg. Was it the defenses of the SEC that made 3-point shooting worse, or were they just that bad? And it's probably a little of this, a little of that, but I think that the really bad 3-point shooting in the league made a lot more coaches in the league comfortable with playing zone that normally wouldn't want to as much. And I would probably put the Gators in that category. I don't think the Gators are like, I know you're not asking for a percentage, but I would put the Gators percentage of zone usage at like 6% if I had to guess this year. So I would take, if this was a Jake Winderman situation, I would ask him for an adjusted line. And I would really, really take the under on that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And for a lot of the reasons that you said, I also think as great as Colin, and I'm not taking away from Colin Castleton, who, you know, deserved every plaudit that came his way last year. And I really thought, you know, was probably the best defensive player in the SEC until the injury. I just think Florida has a bunch of bodies that they can rotate. Like there's so fewer reasons for the Gators to need to utilize zone, even if there's injuries, which is another kind of factor that you think about. I do think Florida will be just the multiple bodies in the front court also helps. So that's just kind of my thought on that. Another fun team one is that Florida was the unluckiest team in the SEC last season, rated 332nd in the country in luck per KenPom. That was just ahead of Mississippi, who was 13th in the SEC in that luck statistic. There's a lot of things that go into that, but I am predicting, and we'll see if Eric disagrees with me, I am predicting Florida has kind of a weird bounce back on that this year. And instead of, you know, you'd say revert to the mean, but I think Florida's luck number will be somewhere in the 1 to 130 range as opposed to 332 to 363.
Like on one hand, like trying to predict KenPom luck is like real it's like sicko behavior or like degenerate gambling behavior. If you were to, like, if some sports book offers betting on KenPom luck metrics, like that is like, yeah, that is some pure degeneracy. So like but I mean, at the same time, the KenPom luck, yeah, the KenPom luck stat is like, and I think I was actually guilty of this for the OGs who really listened to the podcast whenever we started like 5 years ago or forever ago in the past. To be honest, me and probably anyone else who cited it didn't really understand the KenPom luck metric. And since, you know, Ken Pomeroy has talked a little bit more about what goes into the metric, and I think it's a little less sophisticated than I thought. Based on, you know, some of the stuff I had heard. And I think he's even talked, I think, semi-seriously about taking it off as a metric because he doesn't think it's very good, essentially. But people love it. I mean, when there's a team like Providence, when they had their kind of like run of destiny and they were the luckiest team in the country, and it kind of seemed to match, according to the metric, and it really seemed to match the eye test.
Right. Yeah.
Like, it makes for great content when that happens. So I kind of do hope he keeps it, but yeah, I just can't bring myself to like consciously think about too much. So I'm gonna take the optimistic side and say, not only will the Gators be more lucky, they're gonna be a top 25 team in luck this year.
I love it,
because who can really argue with that? You know,
there's one of my favorite luck things is that is Ohio State, who finished dead last in luck last year. The unluckiest team in America, and had finished in the top 20 the year prior. So, I mean, it really can, like,
that's funny. That's really funny.
Things could totally, you know, and I've always thought that that's kind of the more interesting thing about the stat is, like, you know, you look at Ohio State last year and they should have been way better than their record in my view. And then there they were at 363rd in luck. And you're like, man, what happened? One thing that's not luck, at least to some extent. Now, some of you might disagree if you saw like Riley Kugel's shot at Mississippi State, but late shot clock defense. And Florida was atrocious in this area last year. And the numbers really do bear this out, Eric. But in last 4 seconds of shot clock defense, this was 5.7% of Florida's possessions. So not a ton of Florida's possessions, but Florida gave up 0.77 points, which was 12th in the SEC. That's meaning not great. You know, thoughts on that and like whether or not you think Florida's roster, maybe just even a little more athleticism and speed, you know, kind of helps in that area. Or if you think that's another one that's just kind of tough because a lot of times late in the shot clock, you're scrambled.
Yeah, no, I talked about this for much longer than people would care to listen. It's that actually does sound like a, for lack of a better term, unlucky stat for the Gators, because
right.
something that you will, because something you will see, and I'll even go more specific than the fact that, like, to an extent, I do just think that is a lucky stat, because like you said, a lot of times it's going to be somewhat of a desperation heave at the end of the clock. And yeah, like to an extent, is it like how good is the best ISO score on your team? But what you'll see, I truly could talk about this forever. The deeper into shot clock you go, the more likely it is that the possession is going to end in a pick and roll. So like there is far more pick and rolls in the last 5 seconds of shot clocks when you look at college basketball on the whole than there are in the first, in the first 10 seconds. And I don't mean obviously like in transition, like from 30 seconds to 10 seconds on the shot clock. Obviously there's not really going to be like, there's not gonna be a pick and roll at 29 seconds because it's in the full court. But even like once teams pass half, the first 10 seconds, the number of pick and rolls is, you know, not super high. And then the later in shot clocks you go, the more likely it is to end in a pick and roll. So the Gators are actually a good pick and roll defense is what I'm getting at. So you would think that at the end of a shot clock, you're facing a lot of pick and rolls. And we know the Gators were actually quite good at pick and roll defense. So I do think there was probably like, do I trust Florida's pick and roll defense this year? I do. Yeah. I know that, you know, Colin Castleton was a good drop defender. I think that the Gators will have some guys capable of doing that. Some of these guards, I think, are well suited to fighting over these screens and getting into like rear view contests. So I think Florida's pick and roll defense is going to be good, which should lend itself a little bit to that late clock. And then there's a little bit of, you know, isolation ball, of course, at the end of clocks. Look at who Florida had on the perimeter last year. Kyle Lofton, good team defender, not like a one-on-one clamps guy. Myron Jones took a lot of strides as the team defender, not a guy very good in one-on-one defense. Riley Kugel, athletic. I don't think he was a great individual perimeter defender last season, as many young players aren't. So you just have a lot more veteran guys on the perimeter this year. And I think that that'll help in isolation possessions. So while I do think there is the luck there, there's a luck factor there. I think that, yeah, based on the luck, because I think the Gators are good at guarding pick and rolls, I think that there would be some, you know, regression to the mean, some positive regression. I think that math people actually hate the term positive regression because you should just say, you know, regression and whatever. I don't know. And I think the Gators also have some better isolation defenders. And even then, it's like, you know, the Zion Pullen, not like an elite kind of like lock you down kind of guy, a little bit more length that usually helps in an isolation possession where it's usually going to be a pull up. So I actually don't even remember what you said for the metric, but whatever you said, I think the Gators are going to be, or I forget if it's just better than what they were last year, but yeah, I do think they will be much better in late clock defense this year.
Yeah, no, it's going to be hard to not. I mean, they were again at 0.77 points. That was 12th in the SEC. I did not prior to this show. Shame on me, because I actually, you know, I prepared pretty hard to try to put Eric on the spot and make this like opening previews show pretty interesting. And I thought the content we just got there, folks, was really, really fascinating from Eric. But yeah, I didn't look at the national or Power Six number. I just looked at.
I'm sorry. I'm going to throw one back at you.
Okay.
What did you say? What percentage of Florida's defensive possessions did you say it was? 5.9.
Yeah, 5.6.
So here's what I'm going to throw back to you. Because as you also, as Neil also mentioned, at 0.77 points per possession, you said, was that it?
Yeah, that's correct.
So
correct.
Like, of course, anytime the defense gives up a shot that's worth 0.77 points per possession, that is a definite win for the defense. So, even though the, and it's funny, cause even you, like, the Gators were, you know, quote unquote bad at late clock defense, and it was still 0.77 points per possession, because you want to get defenses, or you want to get offenses late in the shot clock, and you want their offense to break down. So it turns into a late ball screen or
right.
isolation. Yep. So what the real measure of success is for a lot of defenses is how many late shot clock possessions can you force? So I'm going to ask you, Neil, do you think the Gators will force more or less, or how do you say it? Do you think they're going to have more or less than 5.6% of defensive possessions in the last 4 seconds? Because a higher number is good and a lower number is bad.
Yeah, I think they'll have more. I do. I just think, and I think you already identified the reasons that I think they'll have more, or some of them, but I think the biggest thing for me is just, I think Florida will be more athletic on the perimeter, and so they can maybe hound the ball a little more defensively. I don't think that they kind of have to rely on as much of sort of collapsing and getting in gaps all the time and things like that. I think they can make it harder for teams to initiate offense with more athleticism outside.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where, like, say the Gators gave up 0.85 points per possession on late shot clock, which would be a lot worse, probably the worst in one of the worst in the country. But if they forced 6.6 percent of possessions to be in the last 4 seconds, that I would still consider that a win, even if the efficiency went down, because you just, like, again, those are still like very low efficiency shots. So yeah, it'll be something to watch to see some of the success of, or to measure success of a defense, see how many late shot clock possessions they force.
Oh, I muted myself. I said I like it. I'm going to transition to players, because if I ask too many more of these team-oriented questions, I really would allow both of us to have a run at our over-unders, and I don't want to do that.
Right.
Because that show will be super fun. But I like this kind of deep dive into analytics, and I know Eric probably hates it so much. No, I'm kidding. So here's an interesting one. And I know our Patreons, and please subscribe to our Patreon. There's a lot of good stuff there. And also this week, I am starting a team-by-team breakdown of SEC rosters, kind of a way too early preview of the SEC just for our Patreon. So going to get some content there in addition to all the cool videos that Eric has dropped in the last couple of months. Please think about subscribing. We have multiple tiers, and anyone that subscribes at all, you don't have to be in the sixth man club, which is the higher tier, to get the content that I'm sending out with these SEC previews. I've prepared 10 of 14, so I'm slacking. I still have four to go, but yeah, almost there. So anyway, one interesting area to kind of look at analytically though would be on players. And I thought Eric did this just phenomenal work on Zion Pullen. And so I will get into a little bit of a usage and effective field goal numbers. And you always expect sort of maybe a slight drop off when somebody jumps from, say, UC Riverside to the SEC. But let's look at a couple of the numbers on Pullen. One number that stands out is that usage number of 20.5% of possessions with the basketball. And then, you know, his points per possession was 0.962, which actually comes out pretty darn good nationally, but not quite an excellent grade. It's a very good grade, which is maybe surprising to some, because we've talked about, you know, how he can really score. Your thoughts on kind of whether or not it's a 20.5% of possession situation? I think that one's pretty straightforward. It's going to be about that, I think, when he's on the floor. Maybe you disagree. And then that points per possession number at 0.96, maybe a little lower as he adjusts to life in the SEC.
I mean, this is like, when having a discussion with anyone, when they ask any question, you've got to think, what is the root? What is really the root question they're trying to get at? And I don't think you were consciously doing this, but really the root question of what you're asking is something that is debated in many Malik Grady group chat, many a Twitter timeline, many a game forum. And it is, you know, will Zion Pullen start or not? Because to me, if he what I'm getting at is if he starts, I'm going to say lower. And if he comes off the bench more, it's going to be higher. Because if he comes off the bench, he's going to be someone who comes in the game, probably as the primary ball handler or something close to it. Be out there with the bench. He's someone that when you look at how Florida's second unit kind of will look, someone that I think will have the ball in his hands a little bit more, someone who's going to be kind of a primary initiator. But like if he starts, and let's also let's envision a world as well, which this triggered a lot of people from John Rothstein when Rothstein suggested that Florida was going to start Walter Clayton, Zion Pullen, and Riley Kugel, those three together. If that's the case, I think that again Zion Pullen's usage will be a little bit lower. But even say it's a Kugel, Pullen, Will Richard, because Will Richard I don't think is going to be a high usage guy, then Pullen's going to go up. So I do feel like this is a little bit of like an environmental question of like how he's going to be used. So I'm going to just, if I had to say, it's tough to go over on that number given the jump. So I'm going to say under, and there's part of me that wants to say that his points per possession will be higher because of, he took a lot of tough shots at UC Riverside and hit a lot of them, but he did have to take a lot of tough ones. So it's one of those situations where I almost wonder if he'll get a couple more open looks, maybe even start to get some open catch and shoot threes, which he hasn't had a lot or taken a lot, and his points per possession will be high. I'm just going to say it. I think usage lower, points per possession higher, because he's not going to be relied on to take the kind of shots he did at UC Riverside.
I love it. I already kind of gave my my view on that, but I did want to discuss this poll that I put up from the last show because Eric was kind of interested in it. And then I was like, you know what? I'm just going to tweet that out and see, where our listeners actually come down on this. And it was pretty lopsided. And it's a good way to frame the question I wrote next, which I asked, which Florida Gators transfer are you expecting more from in 2023 to 2024 to our Twitter followers? And 70.3% said Walter Clayton.
Wow. Interesting. I mean, I'm not surprised by Walter Clayton, but that is a fairly lopsided reaction. And then I would also love to see a smaller poll of people who subscribe to our Patreon and watched our breakdown videos. I would love to see Perry and Jared and Sarah and those people who have watched those videos. I'm actually I'd actually be genuinely interested in people that watch the breakdown videos, what they would think. I am in the Zion Pullen camp the more I've thought about it. But not that I think it's drastic by any means. It's almost also a situation where, because I have come to the personal belief that Pullen will be a little bit better. If Walter Clayton is better, that means that, in my opinion, because I think Pullen will be good, that means that Walter Clayton will be very good. So that'd be great if that's the situation. So I'm glad we put out the poll because that does surprise me. Were you surprised by that?
Yeah, I tweeted kind of a follow-up and was polite, because I didn't mean the question, and I got a couple initial responses that were kind of like, you don't think so. And I was like, no, not at all. Like, it was just genuinely curious because I think both are good players. And I was just kind of interested in where the pulse of the fan base was. And I was surprised it was that lopsided. Also because Pullen has just played more college basketball. So that was kind of another reason. But speaking of Walter Clayton, his usage number at Iona is 3 percentage points lower than Zion Pullen's was. I don't think that should surprise anyone. Again, the reason that UC Riverside got to about 500 or slightly over it was because Zion Pullen was on their team. Walter Clayton played with some dudes, Nelly Joseph, Dennis Jenkins, who transferred to St. John's. I think Nelly Joseph ended up at New Mexico, which is a mid-major that I like. So he was at 17.8 to the 20.8 for Poland, so 3%. But his points per possession were among the best in the country last year at 1.06. I mean, if that's what he brings to the SEC, look out.
Well, and again, like, this is a situation where I kind of said this, and
it's a lazy question. I apologize.
No. I just like, I know that some people took some offense to when I said that I think that he could be Noah Locke. And I think part of that was people not respecting Noah Locke in a way that, you know, I thought they maybe should.
Yeah, well said.
But like, if nothing else, like if he comes in and has 11 or 12 points a game while shooting 40%+ with the 3-point line, like that, to me, that would be pretty wonderful. So to be honest, and then I almost mentioned this earlier about the Zion Poland one, and I didn't, but now I kind of have to, that it was brought up to see that the usage rates were so similar regarding like between those two players. And it's one of those things where like, I'll just like, I would say the best way of putting this was, let's remember Andrew Nembhard and his time at Florida. I'm pretty sure he was never higher than like the fourth highest usage rate player on the Gators. I'll say that again. He was like fourth and fifth, I think, in usage rate. And that's just because, you know, usage rate is really tilted to guys who end possessions. I don't think anyone would watch those Florida teams and say that Andrew Nembhard was not the guy with the ball in his hands most of the time. And like, so again, like I actually find usage rate to be not a great number, because when you're thinking about guys, if you're looking for guys who are comfortable with the ball in their hands, kind of making plays and shouldering that load. Like if you looked at those Florida teams, you would think that Andrew Nembhard was like a role player who was allergic to the ball because he didn't end possessions. But, you know, we know that he added a ton. So the thought of Zion Pullins and Walter Clayton's, you know, quote unquote, well, I'll say usage, not as the usage rate, but just like the amount that they shouldered offensive load. The fact that they're even close to each other is pretty crazy. But again, Walter Clayton is a play finisher, and Zion Poland is someone who initiates more. So, but I do think for Clayton, and again, maybe this is also like I have mentioned that I think that Poland is going to end up being the more impactful guy. I will say that I don't think the usage for Clayton should be particularly high. And I think it should almost be like whatever Will Richards was last year, like that's a kind of similar-ish role to what I see Walter Clayton as, someone who I want to shoot 7 or 8 catch and shoot threes a game, which will still like make that usage number something notable, but it's not like I think he should be running 7 or 8 pick and rolls again. So, you know, and will he take a dip in points per possession? Like, yeah, you got to take that under, but I hope he just takes a lot of open catch and shoot threes. And I hope his effective field goal percentage and points per possession are very high. And I think they will be, just I don't think he's going to be a guy taking a lot of tough shots.
So cool thing about Bart Torvik, which obviously is very high on Florida, unlike say John Rothstein. You've seen some of these way too early prognostications. I know Malik Grady, I think, had like a 4,709 tweet thread about, I'm just kidding, Malik, about John Rothstein's, you know, rankings and whatnot. And you can debate whether or not John's salty, because like there's only a couple of programs in the SEC where he doesn't get scoops. You know, who knows? Not here to pick a fight in the month of August. You know, but one reason that a lot of analytics love the Gators is Tyrese Samuel. And just wanted to give some perspective as to where that comes from, just looking at synergy. So Tyrese Samuel last year against paint, two-pointers taken in the paint. This is a Stat Solutions number, Hoops Lens. 79 two-pointers taken in the paint against Ty Samuel last year, 25 went in. That graded out in the 94th percentile of bigs in the country. You flip over to synergy, and his points per possession against numbers, just really, really marvelous at 0.73. And then his block percentage on 2%. And this isn't a super high block player, but his blocks on 2%, two point shots around the rim. Again, a Hoopslands number at 14%. So he's affecting shots in and around the rim when given the opportunity at a decent rate, 1 out of 6. And then you kind of combine that with the fact that, what was it, 25 of 79 went in, and you get a really tenacious rim protector, even if he's not blocking a ton of shots. Or if you don't want to call him a rim protector because you don't like that vernacular, despite those numbers, what you have is a really good paint defender. And somebody who can, I kind of think, step in for Colin Castleton and maybe in a different way provide Florida really stout defense inside. It's one of the reasons I think he starts. And the numbers really do wipe Micah Hanlockton's numbers out of the water, but we don't need to get into that before we just talk about, you know, maybe Eric's impression of those numbers from Ty Samuel.
Yeah, like his raw block numbers are not very good, which inherently means his block rate numbers are not going to be very good. So I think that it's good to get the bigger picture with how guys are finishing at the rim around him. It's also worth noting that, like, especially with those synergy numbers, it's going to be a lot of like post ups and when guys catch offensive rebounds, kind of shooting around the rim. It's not like these numbers are all like guards streaking through the tunnel to try to finish and what, how many does he, you know, swat away or force misses. So like, there's a lot of excellent big men in the Big East. Like, again, like that's something that I really like with Samuel is like, he's got all like, these aren't like, yeah, they're not highway miles. He's got city miles. He played in a very difficult league that is primarily really difficult talented big men. So I'm actually, to be honest, quite stunned. Like, I thought his numbers there would like not look great or like they'd be kind of pedestrian and you'd have to be like, well, you know, keep in mind the league he played in and the competition he had. So to see that those numbers are excellent, that's super encouraging. I would love to use that as more fuel in my narrative that he's going to be Florida's most impactful incoming transfer. So I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Might even write about it. So I appreciate that. And yeah, so it's just the last thing, and even like you mentioned, like,
go ahead.
You kind of ended with like, and that's why I think he'll start. Like, to me, him not starting is just would be crazy. Like, it's just and again, we can talk about who's going to start alongside him in the front court, but yeah, like getting a fifth year player with what he has accomplished, him not starting is just like not really even entered my. Yeah, I know. And I know when he first, and again, I make another Malik Grady reference and I've, you know, joked about it on the podcast when, you know, when they got him and, you know, he was, you know, like, oh great. Now they've got like their backup center. And I was triggered. Yeah. There's numbers like this, that it's just like that. This is why, like, I just can't imagine a world where he doesn't start. And if he doesn't, I think that it's more likely that something has gone very wrong than the emergence of some other guys to that level. Cause
let's be frank, or it means a promise was made.
Yeah, you know? That's fair too.
Yeah. I think, you know, because the Big East, by the way, was the second best offensive league in the country, according to Hoopslands. So, and I love Hoopslands. I know that they have dived much more into, like, you'll see Hoopslands reference a lot more in NBA articles, as I'm sure Eric knows. But some of their more recent like hoops analysis is pretty interesting. And this is a really good offensive league, and not just because of UConn, right? Like Creighton, great offensive team. So like, he was in a lot of these battles, by the way, just for perspective. And I'm not bearing Hanlockton, because we're talking about a guy that's played a ton of college basketball versus like the Sun Belt freshman of the year. And look, I mean, I'm thrilled that Hanlockton is a Gator. I've said that all along, but his like Hoopslands 2-pointer number was 45 of 85. So teams were 25 of 60 of 69 was the, or 25 of 79 rather was the Samuel number. 45 of 85 was the Hanlockton number. So teams are over 50% on those paint touches. Points per possession, there's a 0.15 difference per synergy from that 0.73 or 0.14. to 0.871 for Hanlockton. So even with the block rate being much higher, you see like these huge distinctions. It's also interesting to note that like a lot of teams now like to attack downhill on blob plays, as I'm sure Eric could talk about much more artfully than I, but Micah Hanlockton on baseline out of bounds defense per Hoopslands, one of the worst players in the country last year, allowing 1.185 points per possession on baseline out of bounds plays. So he got lost a lot, and obviously probably something that Florida will emphasize fixing as he gets ready to play his first basketball in the SEC.
Yeah, that one's interesting. Like I'd have to look, but I do like, if you imagine like a typical, I mean, let's imagine like a box formation that you'll see, or even just like a 1-4 flat. Often teams are of course looking for a back screen or a slip towards the rim. And often when that happens, even if it's not the responsibility of like, say a Micah Hanlockton, like it's not his man that slipped to the rim, he is going to be the closest player to the rim. So if a guard just gets like totally hung up on a guard to guard back screen, and you know, Hanlockton's the player who responds at the last second, 'cause he's just closest there. Oftentimes those players will get credited as, you know, the defender who defended it when it's not really his fault. So I'd have to look into that one a little bit, but I will also say, knowing that league, and I was almost going to mention this with Samuel, like that league is a very post up heavy league, and teams like Louisiana are constantly just trying to like duck in extremely physical, like 6'8", 240 pound guys just get deep post catches. So I do know, again, from the Micah Hanlockton video that I did for Patreon, but yeah, there are times that on those baseline out of bounds plays where it's really easy to get really deep seal post catches, that teams are doing that against Hanlockton because they kind of knew when they had a big physical 6'8" guy that was under the center of gravity for Hanlockton, it was, you know, they bump him underneath the rim and finish. And yeah, I think I need to look a little bit more into the SEC again. Just because, again, I think that last year, and we've talked about this, how many, and we talked about it with some of the players that the Gators are targeting and recruiting for 2024, how many of those like 6'8", 6'9", kind of physical, more, you know, not really under the rim, but I guess I'll say under the rim guys there are, versus, you know, it's actually been a little while since there's been a whole bunch of like 7-footers. So I think that with some of those guys, like I think about some of those Texas A&M bigs, like those are the kinds of guys that at the Sun Belt level gave Hanlockton a lot of problems as a freshman. Again, he's going to be stronger, smarter, more experienced. But like I'm thinking about like a Coleman from Texas A&M, like that's a player who I would feel infinitely more comfortable with Tyree Samuel guarding than Micah Hanlockton. So, but again, we'll have to see. Maybe that's something I need to look into as well. Just kind of the guys that the Gators be matched up with in the league. But yeah, no, it's a good note. It's an interesting one on the baseline out of bounds for sure. It's something to watch for now this year.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. You know, one to his credit though, and this is sort of like the you know, when you think of like just the teams that just roll out 7-footers, at least for me, like, and I'm sure some of our listeners, you think of Florida State. And one thing that the FSU bigs are coached to do and had done quite well for many, many years is get their hands in the passing lanes too, and just use their length to disrupt things, even when it's not blocks. And that's something that Hanlockton was excellent at last year with 41 steals. So if you kind of do that block plus steals number, you get like a player who's capable of being disruptive defensively. And like, it just seems like it's all about learning to be a better positional defender for him.
And it also goes into just the, like how blocks don't tell the whole story, and they often don't tell much of the story. Because yeah, like a Hanlockton's block numbers are incredible. And believe me, like, I'm not saying those don't matter. There is absolutely value to his, like his, the way he's able to just like, again, there's like an offensive rebound or something, and a player is, you know, right at the rim and has a putback attempt. And then here's like Hanlockton, who like doesn't let the ball leave the hand of the player trying to finish because he's just so much longer. Like, there's huge value in that, for sure. But it's not, again, it's not like if you look at his block numbers and think, oh, that's one of the best rim protectors in the country, in my opinion, that would be sorely inaccurate watching the film and looking at even more of these numbers. So yeah, just those, it's a good example to look at the lack of blocks for Samuel or the huge amount of blocks for Hanlockton, and then looking at the numbers of the finishing at the rim numbers to kind of tell a little bit more of the story.
Yes, I agree with that. And, you know, I don't, it is interesting and it's not as if Florida State didn't have some sort of quote unquote more under the rim guys. You know, I don't think, I mean, what did you think of Kamengali? Did you think he was such a unique player? Cause he was 6'9". I know he was listed at 6'10" at FSU, but as soon as he got to the pros, he was no longer listed at 6'10". And I think the Celtics listed him at 6'8", which might be more right. But like, what was interesting about him is so like that block plus steals number for Kamengali was 77. The year that they went to the Sweet 16 and played that thriller with Gonzaga. And I think, but his points per possession against on Synergy were like in that Ty Samuel range at like 0.77. So like, he could do both, right? Like, even though he wasn't, and I'm not comparing him to Hanlockton. I'm just saying that, like, you want to make sure that, like, you don't get too deceived by either number. Like, you don't want to get deceived by that block number when there's other things that are problematic about your defense. But if you can get, you know, that complete package, then it stands to reason, or maybe is really obvious that you have a more complete defensive player.
Yeah, and I mean, like, Kamengali got, you know, NBA opportunity without – I don't think he started a single game at Florida State. And, you know, I think another player that was, like, really, really good was Raekwon Gray, who was kind of the same kind of mold of that for Florida State. So, yeah, as much as the joke is to talk about their, like, 7'3" guys, which they always seem to have and are effective, it's often been the more 6'8" right. guys – And yeah, I just think when you're looking at the way a lot of teams are built, and I hate being like so recency bias of like yeah. just the literal, but like I think you are seeing the like Donovan Clingan type bigs or like Walker Kessler, like yep. you're seeing the guys that are 7'1", 7'2" are the like more just really positionally strong kind of mm-hmm. Guys who can, well, yeah, like that kind of defender. You're seeing those at the highest level. And then you're seeing guys that are a little bit more of like, honestly, like Tyrese Samuel, like not that he's exactly the player we're talking about, but like 6'10" and strong and like, you know, athletic enough, but aren't like freaks. Like those are kind of like, when you look at the best teams nowadays, it's that, or it's like, yeah, you're 6'8", 250-pound high motor kinds of guys. So yeah, I was a big Kamengali fan. I think the reason he was, you know, I don't think he was, I'm trying to remember. I don't remember if he was drafted or not, but it was one of those things that like, you kind of knew when he left college, he was going to get on the team. He was for starting. Yeah, I was like, I'm mixing him up with someone in my head. I think part of it is I just watched, I don't know if you've seen this yet, Neil, there's a very good documentary on Amazon Prime that just came out last week. That's, I forget what it's called, but it's like, it follows the G League. And like, there's like Gabe York is kind of one of the players most kind of most followed, or Ryan Terrell, who played for another very good D3 program, Yeshiva, who's kind of the most dominant. So he's like an Orthodox Jewish player, kind of talking about his experience, trying to be the first Orthodox Jew in the NBA, going through the, and so yeah, it's just, it's a, I'm blanking on what it's called, but I mean, if you go to Amazon Prime and you see something about the G League, you'll know what it is. But anyways, I said, Kamengali makes an appearance. So I was trying to remember, I'm like, oh man, was he one of those, like, you know, undrafted, but you knew he was going to get signed, you know, a second after the draft, but no, first round pick. So, was that a little bit rich? Ultimately, yes. But like, yeah, it just says something when you get drafted without starting a game. So yeah, those are players that I'm very intrigued by, and look forward to the Gators hopefully landing some of those style of players in the 2024, in the 2024 recruiting class.
So to Eric's point about the FSU, Raekwon Gray and Balsa Koprika, who was their 7'1" monster, they combined to allow 0.60 points per possession inside on the team that may have been either the 1 or 2 overall seed in the COVID year. And so that they had all of that stuff combined And then also like the worst defender on that team from an interior defense standpoint was Patrick Williams and by some distance. So like kind of gives you an idea of what they were working with at Florida State. So I don't know. I just kind of thought like a deep analytical dive into a few of the more like pressing roster questions as the season is on the way would be fun. And I appreciate guys, you guys need to know how awesome like Eric Fawcett is on. Like Eric had zero prep for any of this. And like, granted, a couple of my questions were either lazy or kind of ridiculous, but he had no prep and just was like, hey, I'm going to roll through this. So I don't know. I thought that was pretty fun. Eric.
This shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone, but I think you're more just showing who really carries water here for the podcast, does all the actual work for the podcast and who just, you know, shows up to sling take. So I was, you know, thankful for you, Neil, for doing the prep for that. And it was very different than the Jake Winderman over under spectacular, but it like also got me excited for that Jake Winderman episode. So people can look forward to that. I don't know when we're going to do it, but, and I know we were going to do like a recap at the end of the season regarding our predictions. And like, we know that they're going to be horrible. I think we'll probably touch on them when we do the next one, but like, I feel like it was almost going to be so horrible that it was going to be like not very good podcast content to like go through each number. And it would be honestly more like a Festivus airing of grievances where we talk about all the ways we were disappointed last year. So I'm sure we'll touch on it, but I'm looking forward to, I think this will be an even better over under show whenever we end up doing that with Jake, because the prop show is, it was always one of my favorite shows when we did it. And then I think it was just infinitely better when Jake hosted. So I'm just going to assume he's going to do it again. Haven't actually even talked to him, but he's going to do it, I'm sure. So, another thing kind of on that note as well, like at some point here, I'm not sure when I'll actually do it, but you know, I've done my predictions for Florida's incoming transfers every single year. And that's usually, you know, something that is very interesting to people. So at some point I'll have to do that as well. And I'm sure that'll be something we'll talk about, and I'm trying to think about how I can do a deeper dive for Patreon. I think, you know, something that I actually do but don't publish is I actually do projections for every player on the roster, but I've only written about the transfers. So I think I might, for Patreon subscribers, when it comes out, I will open up the Google Sheets spreadsheet and show the projections for every player on the roster and talk a little bit about my process. So I don't know when that'll happen, but it will at some point.
I love it. And we're going to close with an Edge Jarvis question for our buddy Nick De La Torre, because he sent me a message and said, I feel like you guys haven't talked about Edge Jarvis since he committed. And I don't even know if that's true, but it sounds like it might be. So I kind of was like, well, where do I get one from numbers on him? And the one that stuck out to me was that per synergy and hoop lens, he would be Florida's second best defender, and he would have the best rebounding percentage of somebody coming into the University of Florida, which is pretty fascinating to me. He also shot 40% from three, but is a really low sample size of like 13 of 32. So his block plus steals number, speaking of complete players, was 62 last year, because he had 46 blocks for Yale at 1.5 per game. But then his PPP against, on the 2 points, that Hooplin's number that Samuel had that was so impressive was also super impressive. It was 0.76. So you can kind of see a guy who across the board will make his case for a lot of minutes this year, Eric.
Yeah, I actually think like Nick must be an actual listener, because I think he's actually right. Not that we like haven't talked about him, but he's definitely a listener. He's certainly the player that we've talked about the least of the transfers, other than like Rishwane. So it's also one of those situations where he committed so early, so we of course have that like surge of talking about him, but seems like a long time ago. For those who don't know as well, he was one of the later players making it to campus. Because of the Yale, I don't totally understand it, to be honest, and that's when I get in trouble talking about things I don't totally understand. But something about their kind of academic situation is that he had to be at Yale, finishing up school like a lot longer than, you know, a normal or you know, quote unquote, like someone who was going to school elsewhere and transferring to Florida. So he was a little bit later than some of the other guys. So there wasn't as much like inside stuff we were hearing about him. And I do think he's just kind of like his play style is a little bit of like it's not like, I don't think there's anything particularly like divisive about the way he plays. I think we kind of know exactly the way he's going to play. And we can argue about, oh, do we want that kind of, do we want that kind of consistency and the way he's going to, you know, see the floor and be willing to move the ball? Like, you know, do you want that with the starting group or off the bench? Like, that's the thing we can kind of talk about. But I don't think anyone is like, oh, do we think he's going to shoot 150 threes or 50? Like, there's not as many of those conversations we had about him. So, and again, he's a player that I think should start. I think at some point he will kind of command a starting spot. So I'm definitely, you know, a fan of his game and what he can bring for this particular group. But yeah, in the debates about who's going to start in the backcourt, who's going to start in the front court, brings up a lot of like, you know, it's easy to talk about Pullen and Clayton and the backcourt and the front court with Hanlockton and Samuel, particularly when we talk about who should start or who will start or at the center position, I should say. And yeah, we probably should talk a little bit more about Jarvis, who I think I am told, I forget the number exactly, but some people were floating out that his vertical leap numbers were pretty crazy when he came to the Gators and got tested. So yeah, maybe he is a little bit more kind of explosive, a little bit more of a highlight reel guy than we might have expected. But yeah, glad Nick brought it up.
Yeah, definitely not a guy that I think it's totally true. Not a guy that we had gotten too deep into. By the way, one real on the air correction, because usually I have to do this on Twitter. They had team workouts. It was the first one that I said they had gotten back to Thursday. So Billy Donovan was there, addressed the team on Thursday, which I'm pretty sure was probably pretty cool for a lot of those guys, including people on staff. Maybe Torian Green might have taken a nap, but you know, no, I'm messing around, but I'm sure that was a pretty neat way to get things going. So we will be back with another big time show. Going to talk a little recruiting. No, I'm kidding. We're not going to talk recruiting. we'll get into some player by player roster previews and things of that nature in the next week. We'll let Eric, the man, sign us off after his impressive impromptu performance today.
Wow, glad I you know made you happy out there on the court. Just, you know, doing my best for the team and you know, all those cliches and all that. But, yeah. Go Gators and keep attacking closeouts.